Welcome to WRHU's One-on-One Stories. For the next 30 minutes, our host, Dr. Gregory Barroza, will talk with influential and inspirational guests. One-on-One Stories explores all areas of life and lifestyles affected by health, fitness, nutrition, medicine, mental attitude, and general well-being. Our guests discussed unique aspects of their lives and work, including current, controversial, and offbeat subjects of interest to all of us. It's One-on-One Stories with Dr. Gregory Barroza.
Doctor, doctor, give me the news. I got a bad case of loving you. No pills gonna cure my ear. I got a bad case of loving you.
Randy Gordon spent 40 years in the world of professional boxing. No one else has ever seen the sport from so many different angles and from such lofty seats. From his days as a wheelchair-bound, severely injured boy in 1959 to his professional career as a fighter, writer, reporter, referee, editor-in-chief of the internationally prestigious Ring magazine, New York State boxing commissioner, and now, along with former heavyweight boxing championship contender Jerry Cooney, he is co-host of SiriusXM's At the Fights. I must add personally that in his book, The Glove Affair, Randy lays out a riveting story of an honorable life, well-lived. In certain circles, many would consider Randy to be a true mensch. Today we will broadcast part one of a two-part series discussing the events within Randy's book and his life. Randy, it's my distinct honor and privilege to welcome you to my show, One-on-One Stories.
Doc, it is a pleasure being here. I'm really honored about this.
Well, I'm honored to have you, and I can sense the enjoyment you have in being who you are and all the life's journey that you took to get to this point, and that's the thrill of it.
You know, this year, you had mentioned about the burn and everything like that, which obviously is, there are moments in a person's life that always will stay with you. And that's a moment that was just a landmark for me. It was 60 years ago this past summer where I sustained this severe burn on my right leg in an explosion. And it almost cost me my life. It almost cost me my leg. Obviously, I'm still here. The leg is still attached to me. And at 70 years old, I could probably outrun most people. So, I mean, it was perseverance, it was belief in whatever you want to say, a higher power or whatever, it was belief in myself that I could do it when I was told I couldn't do it. And it set the stage for everything else in the rest of my life. When I was told, you can't do this or you can't do that, I already did the impossible. Nothing else was impossible.
Truly inspiring words, Randy. Our stories program primarily concentrates on unique people with inspiring stories, and you score 100% on both counts.
Well, I it's just that belief. I mean, I never thought of it like as accomplishing anything. I just knew, hey, I'm going to do this. Where they say I'm never going to walk again, I said, I will walk. And then they said, you're never going to walk without a limp. I said, yes, I am. They said, you're never going to run again. Well, again, here I am, 60 years after being told that, still being able to outrun. I'm so proud of that, that I could still motor like the little athlete I once was.
Well, I read your book cover to cover, and I didn't intend when I started reading it to read it cover to cover, but I couldn't put it down, and it truly inspired me. I almost took up boxing. That was one of the things that could have been a career, along with architecture and building, but I finally decided to follow my first love, and that was veterinary medicine and horses. And like you, something burned inside me, a passion that created me to go in that direction. But I'm just as joyous as you are today to tell you that at the end of that long journey, that it was all worthwhile. And still, I still have my other passions, my other girlfriends that I never married, so to speak. And I must say, too, that your convictions do not allow you to shy away from honesty and fairness, and that's one of the things I picked up in your book. And I know through your own words that you're very proud of that.
Extremely proud. And I mean, you know, while the burn more or less shaped who I am, it was something I did in 1982, by telling the truth, I wound up getting fired, and we'll get into that, from a job that I loved. And it turned out that because I got fired from that high-profile job, the then governor of New York, Governor Mario M. Cuomo, heard about that. And when he went shopping for a new commissioner in 1988, he asked his crew, go out, get me this Randy Gordon guy, because he got fired for telling the truth. I want a guy like that on my team. And that has been basically the cornerstone of my entire career. It made me as commissioner, and it just made me, I think, who I am.
Well, Randy, we may touch upon that a little bit further along, but I'm glad you brought it up. And one of the old sayings that I truly believe in is that for every door that someone closes, another one will open up for you. And you found that out firsthand.
Oh, no question about it. I mean, a number of years ago, there was a movie called Sliding Doors. Like, let's say you're about to get on a train. You're single, and you see this beautiful woman on the train. And she happens to glance out the window. She's on the train, and you're on the platform. And just as you get there, the doors close. And she continues to look at you, and you look at her, and you just say, wow, I just missed the train, just missed talking to her. What if the door stayed open another second, you made it in, and you got to speak to her? Maybe something would have come of that. Your life would have gone maybe in a different direction. Sliding doors is just about where you are at a certain moment, right place, right time, right place, wrong time, whatever. You're where you intended to be, but not at that moment. Wrong place, wrong time. A lot of people are just in the wrong place at the wrong time. Sliding doors. One quick second can mean the change of a life. And I've always seemed to be in that right place at the right time.
You know, it's interesting. This is not a spiritual program here, but you have to believe that there's either some power above or there's some reason that things happen the way they happen. And maybe for the younger listeners who want to hear this, some things are meant to be a certain way, and you just have to accept them.
Oh, no question about it. I mean, you know, I guess if I was to tell a young person this, you know, yeah, sure. But I think in everybody's life, and let me just say, I am not an ultra-religious person at all. But there's some way that I guess the burn made me a believer. And it certainly made me a believer in myself, that I could accomplish anything that I put my mind to, because everything that I wanted to do in life, and this includes my schoolwork. Listen, I was never very great in math. I struggled through high school and college in math, but I was determined, my very last math course that I ever took, I said, you know what? You haven't really studied math. You don't go do your homework. This last course, Randy, you are going to sit down and you are going to read your math books, your math notes, and everything else. You're going to go for extra help, and you're going to study it the way you study sports. I aced the course. I showed myself I could do it. I aced it easily. I mean, never getting so much as a question wrong. Again, I proved something to myself. And I always felt if I could do it, not the brightest guy in the world, but a guy who just believes in himself, anybody could do it.
Well, I couldn't agree with you more wholeheartedly. I spent a significant portion of my career teaching. And also, I've got my own children, and I'm now back helping out at a university. But there's an art to being a student, too. And there's a technique to learn how to coordinate and organize your thoughts and your study skills and this. There's many a young person that really didn't think they had the potential to do certain things in life. With a little encouragement, and that's a big word, and you know that from boxing, to encourage someone to be their best, it's amazing what kind of boundaries don't exist as long as they believe in themselves.
It's all about belief. I mean, I could be working with a fighter. If I don't think this fighter's anything, it's going to be very tough for me to give everything inside of myself to him. And I do work with a number of amateur fighters right now. In the next year or two, I'm going to be turning them professional. I've sat down with them. These young men have become like my sons. And I totally believe in their abilities. I believe in them. They believe in me. They believe that I'm going to take charge of their career and put them into the meaningful fights that will take them to the top of their profession, of their chosen profession. They believe in me. I believe in them. And belief is that word. Because my whole life has been on believing in yourself.
To pound your drum, your credits, acknowledgments at the beginning of your book, I was impressed. 3+ pages of thank yous to all the people I'm sure that you ever met along the way. Quite a star-studded collection of people that you thanked. And then you saved the greatest honor for your foreword to Tracy Morgan, who himself had a horrific accident in 2014. And I'm sure there was a certain pathos there that asked you to relate to him, because what's a comedian have to do with a boxing book?
Tracy Morgan, as many of us know, is the comedian, the actor, who you might know him from The Last OG. Right now he's filming Coming to America 2 with Eddie Murphy in a hilarious role. I'm just going to leave it at that. But when I met Tracy a few years ago, it was shortly after he came out of his coma, came out of the hospital. He was in a horrific car accident on the Jersey Turnpike. A Walmart truck struck the car that he was in from behind. The guy, the driver, I believe, fell asleep. He had been driving for hours and hours and hours. Fell asleep at a high speed, crashed into Tracy's car. It was a fiery wreck. Everybody in the car was injured. Tracy's best friend was killed. Tracy suffered numerous and broken bones, a fractured skull, a brain injury, put him in a coma for days. And as it is, he was a funny man who loved people. But when he survived this, Tracy said, "I am going to dedicate the rest of my life to helping people heal, to making them laugh." And he believes that laughter is a medicine. I truly believe that too. And when I met him, he came up as a guest on my show at Sirius XM Radio. And he's a boxing fan. He knew me. He knew Gentleman Jerry Cooney, my co-host. I started asking him off the air about his accident. And he said, "Until you've gone through something that nearly kills you," and most people never, thankfully, go through that. He said, "But if you have," and then I related the explosion that I was in. And suddenly, Tracy and I found this bond. And he began to come back over and over to my show. We became friends. And when I was done writing the book, I still didn't think he was going to do it. I said, "Trace, you know I'm writing this book, right? Would you consider writing my foreword?" And he just looked at me and said, "You want me to write your foreword? You want me to write your foreword?" And I thought maybe I was going to get yelled at or something. He basically starts to cry. He said, "Why me? Not Sugar Ray Leonard." And I said, "Because, Tracy, they haven't been through what I was through. You have been." And with that, he asked me, "When do you need it?" And I said, "I don't know, maybe a month or two." 3 days later, I receive an email from Tracy. It was the foreword. I got to tell you, I sat there, I read it. I started to cry. Very emotional. But when I read that, I said, "Oh my God, he put it together in hours." That's Tracy Morgan. And everything Tracy does, I just, you know, outside of his family, his beautiful family, I am his biggest fan.
Beautiful story. Thanks for sharing. You know, I'd say that the most important thing amongst athletes, true scholars, journalists, I don't care what you say, you got to have a big heart. And I mean, you have to understand people, and you have to be able to put your heart into your passion. And I think that's what you proved, and I think in your book you certainly did. And that's what you proved by giving that honor to Tracy. I wanted to ask you, most of the boxers that we know come from underprivileged, poor backgrounds. Not all of them, but most of them. Is that a common theme, or is that the only avenue they have to break into society, so to speak? Or do you know some affluent fellows who just say, or women, who say, you know, I love the sport so much, that's what I'm going to do? Give me your comments on that.
Well, I do know some affluent people who went into boxing, and I will tell you, I'm one of the affluent. You know, what in the world am I doing in the world of boxing? My father was an airline pilot. I didn't come from some ghetto. My dad was an airline pilot. I used to fly with mom and dad, me and my brother. We'd get on the planes, and all my life, we'd be traveling all over the world. And back in the day before 9/11, people can't picture this. The captains usually left the door to the cockpit open. Now, I think everybody who's listening can't picture this. You're sitting on a plane. You're going to Florida today. You're going to the Bahamas. You're going to Mexico. The door to the cockpit remains closed. The only time you get a peek in there is when you're first getting on the plane. You turn to your left. You look. Oh, there's the cockpit. That's where they fly this machine from. But my father used to open the door, and then he'd make the announcement, and you'd hear,
this is Captain Gordon speaking. Anybody would like to come up and see what we do here in the cockpit, why don't you, in orderly fashion, come on up and we'll show you exactly what it is that we do here. And I got a little surprise for you, too.
My father used to let all the kids, he'd get out of his seat and let the kids sit there. And then, of course, the co-pilot would be sitting there, and they put it on lock, where the kid really, he could turn the control stick, but the plane wouldn't move. And my father said, turn a little bit to the left, and then turn a little bit to the right, and the kid would think he's flying the plane. And then my father said, you know, you're flying the plane now. You want to take us down? And the kid's, I'm flying it? And this went on all the time with my father. We'd be going to California on a 5-6 hour trip, and it would be the entire trip. People would be going into the cockpit. You will never, ever see that done again. Today, the pilot wants to go to the bathroom. He calls the galley first. They set up the cart in the aisle for obvious reasons. And then once the serving cart is in the aisle so nobody can get past it, the pilot looks through his little peephole, sees the flight attendant standing there. And then what he does is he opens the door. He comes out. They talk for a moment. And then he disappears into the bathroom. And when he goes back in, he gives a little... And the other pilot will then just reach back, open the door, and let him back in. So to think the days that my father did that. So there's the affluent me going into boxing. Then there's the kids brought up in the ghetto. And one of the names I'm going to give you is Mike Tyson. Mike Tyson was a ghetto kid. His father left home and never met his father. He didn't meet his father until he became heavyweight champion. Then his father figured, you know, my son is now the heavyweight champ. I'm going to call him. I'm not going to repeat what Mike Tyson told him, other than basically it was, get lost. You know, what do I need you now for? His mama, she was there, but that was about it. And what Mike Tyson had was his friends were the pigeons that he raised up on the roof of the projects. Now, what is a kid like this going to do? Get a baseball scholarship, a football scholarship, a golf scholarship? No. You get into something that you do every day in the ghetto. Your fists. He fought and he fought and he fought. He told me about a story one day when I was listening to Mike tell it. Mike was walking down the street one day at about 12, 13 years old. petting one of his pigeons. And a neighborhood tough guy, about 18 years old, said, "Hey, Mike, can I see the pigeon?" Mike hands the bird over to the guy, who proceeds to put his hands around the bird's neck and snaps its neck. Tyson, I was in a room with him, just the two of us, when he told me this story. He said, I went, "No!" In my book, I write that, and I said, the scream reverberated through the ghetto. The tough guy gave Tyson the bird back. Tyson placed the dead bird on the ground and then exploded. This barely 13-year-old kid then jumps on the 18-year-old kid, beating him almost to bloody death, leaned over the guy who was still breathing, and said to him, "You're going to probably die here. But if you don't die, just know if I ever see your face again, I will kill you." I asked Mike, "Did you ever see him again?" Mike shook his head, "No." A lot of these ghetto kids, what do they have? They fight their way out of the ghetto. They're going to go to college. They're going to get a scholarship. Not happening. And boxing is made up of so many Mike Tysons, men and women, who come to us from the ghettos basically of America, and then some of the other ghettos all around the world. And they turn into upstanding, outstanding citizens. Muhammad Ali wasn't from a ghetto. Muhammad Ali was from a blue-class family who, when his bike was stolen when he was about 11 years old in Louisville, Kentucky, he got angry, wanted to find the guy who stole his bike. And he told a local police officer, "If I find him, I'm going to beat this kid up." The officer said, "Why don't you come down to the local PAL and take out your anger on a heavy bag?" And Cassius Clay then went in. He wasn't Muhammad Ali yet. Cassius Clay then went in and began hitting a heavy bag. Little did we know that all of a sudden he was going to fall in love with this and become one of the greatest fighters of all time. All areas of life, and in all my years in boxing, somewhere around 50-some-odd years, I have met, because of my involvement in boxing, some of the greatest fighters ever. I have hung with politicians, actors, athletes. I mean, you know, my friendship with Tracy Morgan, Governor Mario Cuomo, one of the greatest orators and politicians I think you'd ever want to meet. And just on and on and on. I've met presidents. I've met just stars in Hollywood. And they're all major fight fans. I mentioned Eddie Murphy before. Eddie Murphy is a major boxing fan. I can't even tell you how many people in Hollywood love the fight game. So it doesn't matter what walk of life you come from, but generally it's the underprivileged who get into the sport.
I boxed, and I also did some jiu-jitsu, and I've learned from the martial arts that even these rough, tough guys, the underprivileged guys, who otherwise could end up on the streets fighting their whole life, they gain a certain self-respect and a certain respect and dignity in dealing with their colleagues. Some of that is just survival, because there's some young, skinny, unimpressive-looking people I've gone up against that have whooped my butt. And then there's some big dudes who got me, and I whooped their butt.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a matter of respect. You just never know who you're meeting. And when you walk into the gym, into the dojo, wherever you walk, you learn the first thing is you respect, and of all things, you respect your mentor, your sensei, your trainer.
You bow.
And so I think that some of these people that you're saying, later in life, they become very appreciative of what they were given through that sport.
No question about it. I mean, there's an expression in many of, I think, both men and women in their respective locker rooms. A lot of locker rooms will have all kind of sports sayings around. And one that always meant a lot to me, because I'm a little guy, stretching it, I might be 5'6". And I always loved this expression. It's not the size of the dog in the fight. It's the size of fight in the dog. And hey, Joe, our producer, as I was saying that, he was mouthing it right along with me. Everybody knows that, but it's so true. This little old guy, a number of years ago on the subway, I got these golden gloves hanging off my neck. When I was commissioner, I was on a crowded subway train headed to my office downtown. My office at the New York State Athletic Commission was right across the street from City Hall. And I'm taking the subway there, and in this very crowded train, I see a guy crushed up against me, looking, sizing me up, and you could almost read his mind. Little guy, golden gloves, I want them, I'm taking them, I'm just going to wait till the next stop. They're mine. And I was prepared for him, and I read his body language completely. At the next stop, which he didn't know was also my stop, his hand flashed out and went to my gloves. And as his hand got to my neck, and it was forcefully, it wasn't like he was going to ask me, what are those? The hand came out and slammed on my chest. Before he got any further, I cracked a right hand off the side of his jaw, followed by an elbow across his jaw. He never knew what hit him. He went down and out. People were screaming on the train. I reached in my pocket. I took my business card, and it said, Boxing Commissioner, State of New York. And I said, I'm the Boxing Commissioner. Everybody started applauding. I walked into my office, and I said to my secretary, Michelle, the police are going to be calling here in a few moments. She said, why? And I told her what happened. A few moments later, the police called, and they said, can we speak to the commissioner? And she said, sure. They said, we're coming up. They said, we called for paramedics. The guy's jaw is shattered. What did you hit him with? How many times did you hit him? I told him what happened. He said, we've got about six witnesses. The guy actually tried to take me to court. But because of all the witnesses and everything, he said, I just wanted to look at your gloves. No, he didn't. The jury was overwhelming. They basically told the guy, you're out of here.
I want to thank today's guest, Randy Gordon, for sharing his insights into the world of boxing across a multitude of real-life experiences. This concludes part one of our two-part series. Please listen again next week as we continue our discussion. We encourage our listeners who have greater interest in the show or previous shows to visit our website, www.oneononestories.com, or email me via info@oneononestories.com with any comments, feedback, future show suggestions, and or recommended guests and topics. Again, Randy, the commish, our sincere thanks for sharing your time, expertise, and personal story. It's been a pleasure.
Doc, it has been more than a pleasure for me. It has been an absolute honor. Thank you so much.